Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, you may have thought that bipartisanship was dead in the water in Washington, but last night in his State of the Union address, President Obama did manage to find the one tiny patch of common ground left.
And if there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. I hated it. I hated it. You hated it. It was about as popular as a root canal.
Well, I suppose dentists would say that root canals are essential for good dental health, as dentists are for the entire economy, since most of them are small business owners. And last night, President Obama shifted the emphasis of his domestic program to small businesses and helping them create new jobs. So what is the president proposing and how exactly will it work? With us is Binyamin Applebaum. He's banking reporter for The Washington Post. And Binya, the president wants to take $30 billion of the bailout money that the big banks have paid back to the federal government and use it to help community banks give small loans to stimulate small businesses. The White House has been talking about this for some 3 months now. So what exactly do we know about the details?
Yeah, so this has been kicking around for a while, like you said, and the basic idea is to do more of what we did last year, which is to give banks capital, money that they hold in reserve, that allows them to make more loans with the deposits that they hold from their customers. Small banks got a lot of that money last year, but the White House believes that there is more appetite for it, and that if it can get more of that money into the hands of small banks, they will be able to make loans to businesses in their communities.
And when you say small banks, referring to banks with less than $1 billion in assets?
We haven't heard the exact line, but that would be a typical line for this kind of program.
And they would be able to borrow some 3 to 5% of their assets out of that $30 billion?
They would receive an investment from the federal government equal to about 3 to 5%, right?
And the idea is they would then forward that as loans to small businesses. But you've been reporting extensively on the problems that small banks are already facing. And they've been failing at very high numbers for the past year, as you've told us previously on this program. So how does this program itself help these small banks?
Well, the reason this program has been kicking around for a while is that no one has quite been able to figure out how to make it work. Small banks are extremely reluctant to take federal aid because of the various strings attached to it. The banks that are willing to take it generally need it because they're not in very good condition financially, and so they need it to patch holes rather than to make new loans. No one has quite figured out how to get more money to healthy banks that might actually be in a position to make more loans.
Huh. Well, given that, and the question, as you said, will the banks actually lend the money? I mean, we're going to hear a little bit later in the program from a small business owner who's afraid that the banks will just hold on to these extra funds that they're getting. So will there be lending requirements? Do we know specifically, or is that small business owner right to worry?
He is right to worry. The fact of the matter is that banks are already holding hundreds of billions of dollars of money that could be used to make new loans. They say that they don't get enough demand for new loans. We hear from lots of small businesses who say that they would love to get loans, but they haven't been able to find a bank that's willing to make one. It's a real problem. It reflects the caution that banks are feeling over the bad loans that they made in recent years. And it's not at all clear that this will break the logjam.
Well, that's on the lending side of things. And here's the president last night also laying out tax incentives that he believes would help small businesses.
I'm also proposing a new small business tax credit, one that will go to over 1 million small businesses who hire new workers or raise wages. While we're at it, let's also eliminate all capital gains taxes on small business investment and provide a tax incentive for all large businesses and all small businesses to invest in new plants and equipment.
So, Binya, how exactly would a elimination of the capital gains tax on small businesses then lead to more jobs?
So this is a good example of something that sounds a lot more impressive than it may prove to be in practice. Under current federal law, if you purchase stock in a small business that's defined as a company with less than $50 million in assets, you are only, and that stock appreciates over time, you hold it for more than 5 years, you sell it, you make some money, you're only taxed on 50% of those profits. And when the stimulus package was passed last year, they increased that exclusion to 75%, and the president is now proposing to increase it to 100%. So if you buy stock in a small business, you now would not be taxed on any money that you make from the investment. The idea is that that will encourage investments in small businesses. Small businesses can grow and hire and stimulate the economy. But as that trajectory suggests, we're talking about a fairly narrow category of investment, and it's not clear how large the impact would actually end up being.
Well, that's Binyamin Applebaum, banking reporter for The Washington Post, speaking with us about small banks and small businesses and the president's proposals to help both that he made last night in his State of the Union address. Binyamin, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Well, another lesson that the president said he learned in the past year: Americans want him to focus less on Wall Street and those big banks and more on Main Street.
Some are frustrated. Some are angry. They don't understand why it seems like bad behavior on Wall Street is rewarded, but hard work on Main Street isn't. Or why Washington has been unable or unwilling to solve any of our problems. They're tired of the partisanship and the shouting and the pettiness. They know we can't afford it.
And one of those frustrated people is Jeff Zimmer. He founded Abbas Instruments. They make scientific instruments for a wide range of industries in Holliston, Massachusetts. He founded it in 1982, and now he has 17 employees. And Jeff Zimmer saw sales plummet last year by 25%. And Mr. Zimmer, how deeply do you feel the frustration that the president was talking about last night?
Oh, I feel it very personally, and a lot of my friends and business associates feel it as well. Total frustration with the banks getting all of the money and very little, if any, orders ever being placed with businesses that actually employ people and make things for other people.
So you're both feeling the squeeze of not being able to get credit and not getting orders for your business itself?
Well, I've been a very lucky one. I have a very good local bank. However, that hasn't been the issue. The issue has been placing orders. People are just not placing orders. The money isn't going to people who produce or have real life needs or incomes. It's all going to a bank, and if you don't have orders, the banks aren't interested in loaning you money for probably a good reason. You know, you have no orders.
Well, I suppose that brings us then to one of the key proposals that the president made last night. He suggested helping small businesses like yours by a plan of funneling $30 billion of TARP funds to small banks, which would then hopefully filter down to small businesses through additional loans. So it doesn't sound like you think that that's a plan that's really going to help small business.
I don't think that's viable at all, because, you know, you're going to give more banks more money to, once again, look out and say, is anybody credit worthy? And the test is going to be, do you have business? Well, where are the orders?
Well, so then how do you think, from your perspective, the government, the president, should go about trying to increase the economy to get those orders to you?
Take the $30 billion and spend it on something you want to do. Build a new rail infrastructure. Decide to go to Mars. You know, pick a big project. Decide that you're going to do it. Make sure it, you know, contributes to the society as a whole. Then your money's going to gain tenfold. So you're going to spend $30 billion, you'll get $300 billion worth of impact. Giving it to a bank gives you almost zero impact because there are no orders to fill.
Well, you mentioned a railroad project or a massive public works project, and today President Obama is in Tampa, Florida, to talk about releasing $8 billion in funding for a high-speed railroad and 13 rail corridors. So help me understand, though, how would a massive railroad project like that help your business making scientific instruments?
Well, believe it or not, everything is dependent. If you're going to make it here, you're going to have to build an infrastructure. You're going to have to build manufacturing. All of that I support. A manufacturing process requires vacuum equipment. Well, I supply vacuum equipment. It all trickles down. All the vendors, suppliers, everything that goes into it employs people. So, as I say, you'll gain 10 times when you spend money like that as opposed to giving it to banks. Banks will simply give their executives bigger bonuses. I don't think we need more mansions on the Hamptons.
Well, there's not a lot of political support for another sort of huge public works stimulus project like these.
Well, then they need to come up with another way of placing orders, because there has to be some way to generate those orders for supporting small business. Small business can't live on loans alone. They need to actually have business.
Well, there are other economists and politicians, as you know, who think that another way of getting the engine of the economy going is through tax cuts. The president, again, yesterday proposed a tax credit for small businesses to hire new employees. Would that encourage you? Would that help you bring more people on board?
No. I need customers with money to spend. You know, a tax credit is great. That'll maybe factor in 5% towards me, you know, hiring someone after I get an order. But it's not going to change the fact that I don't have orders or I do have orders.
So no business coming in then. I guess, does that also make the proposed capital gains tax cut for small businesses not so attractive to you?
Well, at the moment, no. But in the long term, yes. That's a significant interested item that I heard last night. That would be a great thing if the Republicans could get their hands out of their pockets and actually get on board with some of this legislation. I'm tired of seeing bills go through Congress that have no Republican votes on it. I mean, what are they doing? Sitting down there waiting for something that really is down their aisle instead of, you know, in a common good?
And Mr. Zimmer, if I understand correctly, I mean, you're taking Republicans to task as much as Democrats, but you yourself are a Republican and you didn't even vote for President Obama. So
I know. And quite frankly, though, everything I heard last night, Obama has some awfully good points. And the Republicans need to, you know, reevaluate their attitude, because, you know, now they're becoming an obstacle to moving the country forward. From a business point of view, that's a dangerous place to be.
So it sounds like you're calling for all of the United States government to get its act together to help small businesses.
Well, yeah. I mean, really. Don't we employ most of the people? We can also grow the economy the fastest, assuming that we can get Congress to stop, as they say, sitting with their hands in their pockets and actually do something and not just supplying banks with more money to sit on.
Well, that's Jeff Zimmer. He founded Abbas Instruments in Holliston, Massachusetts. He spoke with us about President Obama's plan to help small businesses like his. Mr. Zimmer, thank you so much for making the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Well, we'd love to hear what you thought about the President's State of the Union address last night. And you can contact us in any way just about possible. You can go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send us an email, or scroll down at that website and leave a comment there on the homepage, or use a telephone. Pick it up and call us at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And just ahead, three detainees at Guantanamo Bay died one night in 2006. The military called it suicide, but new information points to a cover-up. And coming up later in the show, why CBS is breaking its long-standing tradition against advocacy ads in the Super Bowl. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. One topic that didn't come up during the President's State of the Union speech was his promise last January to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center within a year. But it's still open. Nearly 200 prisoners remain there. And new reporting indicates that the Obama administration may have inherited and perpetuated a cover-up involving the deaths of three prisoners there on June 9, 2006. Official reports out of the Pentagon called the deaths suicides, but eyewitness accounts from several soldiers on duty that night tell a different story, one that points not to suicide, but homicide. Scott Horton writes about the case for Harper's Magazine, where he's contributing editor. And Scott, as we said, the military presented the deaths as suicides in an official report. Can you take us through that official account of what actually happened that night?
According to the official narrative, these prisoners bound their feet, bound their hands, stuffed cloth down their throats, attached a noose to the top of a wire wall, put their head through the noose, and jumped off to commit suicide. Now, this is while hands and feet are bound. So this was a feat of tremendous, I would say, acrobatic daring. And for three prisoners to do this the same way, simultaneously, and they weren't even in side-by-side cells. So it's just very, very difficult to understand how this conceivably could have happened.
So that's the official account, but it, of course, doesn't square at all with what one Sergeant Joseph Hickman saw that night and what he told you that he saw. And before we get to his eyewitness account, why don't you tell us a little bit about Sergeant Hickman?
Well, Sergeant Hickman has had a distinguished military career. In fact, while at Guantanamo, he distinguished himself by putting down a prison riot. And in fact, he was awarded a medal for that and immediately upon returning was promoted.
Mm. So it must have taken something pretty disturbing within him to come forward and give this alternative account. So what exactly did he see that night in 2006?
He told me that he had been haunted by what he saw that night. He notes, beginning about 7 o'clock that evening, a vehicle that was used just for prisoner transports called the paddy wagon pulls up in front of Camp 1, which is where these three prisoners were being held, and picks up one prisoner, departs with it. It returns within 20 minutes. It picks up a second prisoner. And he watches exactly how this paddy wagon moves. And he sees it's moving in the direction of a secret facility called Camp No. The name comes from No, It Does Not Exist. That's what they were supposed to say if anyone asked about it. But nevertheless, by about 7:30, the paddy wagon returned a third time, picked up a third prisoner. This time, Sergeant Hickman decided to go to the outer checkpoint and see exactly where this paddy wagon was going, and he was able to confirm that, yes, it was going to Camp No. And then by 11:30 in the evening, he notices the paddy wagon has returned to the camp and is backed up against the detainee clinic to unload something.
Now, is there any evidence that Camp No could have been or is one of the CIA-operated sites, so-called black sites that have been operating around the world?
Yes, there is some evidence. We raised that issue, and there's been no denial whatsoever from the Obama administration. But let's go to the observations of the guards. They recall being on patrols around Camp No and hearing the screams and cries of prisoners come out of it. And they also note and associate this facility with some government figures not wearing uniform, they assume are CIA agents, and also two particular individuals who are later identified as psychologists.
So the soldiers at Guantanamo had actually seen these officials around the prison, which may point to Camp No possibly being a CIA black site. But let's get back to the story. Soldiers see the paddy wagon return and drop something off, maybe bodies, to the camp medical facility. And later that night, news of the deaths gets around. The next morning, the camp commander assembles the guards and tells them that what they will hear in the news will differ from what they know, and he warns them not to talk, and he tells them actually that their emails are being monitored. And the media then does go on to report the story as a suicide, and an official military report says the same thing. Now, that was all in 2006, of course, under the Bush administration. But if we fast forward to 2009 and the Obama administration, this is when Sergeant Hickman decides to come forward with his alternative account. And you report that the Obama Justice Department ultimately decides to do nothing.
Well, we spent quite a bit of time tracking everything the Obama Justice Department had done to investigate this. I interviewed all the people I could find that they interviewed. I interviewed them about the interviews. And as one of them told me, it was as if the Justice Department people conducting this investigation wanted to check off a box, talk to him, but really did not want to learn anything about what happened that evening. And in fact, one of the amazing things we learned was that the Justice Department official who was put in charge of this had told the attorney for Sergeant Hickman that the investigation was over before the investigators had contacted the principal corroborating witnesses. And she told him it was over because they couldn't find information that corroborated what Sergeant Hickman had said, but they had not contacted the witnesses and interviewed them. And I did, and I found that they did corroborate what Sergeant Hickman had to say. So it's quite clear that the Obama Justice Department wanted to close the cover on this and seal it as quickly as they could.
Or, as you write, they faced a choice between the rule of law and the expedience of political silence. And it seems, according to you, that they chose the latter.
Well, in their view, silence is golden in this case.
Scott Horton is contributing editor for Harper's Magazine, and he spoke with us about the death of three Guantanamo detainees in 2006. Their deaths were labeled suicides by the United States military, but accounts from several soldiers on duty that night are raising questions over whether those deaths may have actually been homicides. Scott Horton, thank you so much for speaking with us.
A great pleasure to be with you.
And still ahead today, hooray for haggis. Yeah, I said haggis. After a 20-year ban, the authentic Scottish delight will soon be back in the United States. Back in a moment, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Travel to almost any city in the world, and if you're a little thirsty, chances are you will be able to find an Irish pub. That, of course, reflects the fact that the Irish are all over the world. For nearly two centuries, they've gone abroad in search of work, and the Celtic Tiger economic boom led some to believe the years of emigration were over. But now, as the BBC's Paul Moss reports, once again, more and more people feel they've got no choice but to leave the country.
So slow, slower, slowest, heavy, heavier.
This wasn't how things were supposed to work out. Maria Carney comes from Galway and spent the last decade working in business management. Now she's learning how to teach English as a foreign language.
Getting work at the moment is quite difficult. Even if there are opportunities, it's not very well paid. So if you're faced with those sort of obstacles, you may as well look abroad and see if you can at least live in another country. So I'm going to have to leave my partner behind. Not a great situation, but that's the choice that I have.
Where are you hoping to go and find work?
I have a job interview for South Korea.
South Korea?
I know, yeah. Yes, South Korea. I would like to work here in Ireland, just work dried up, so it didn't work out.
It hasn't worked out for a lot of people. The company I2I has been running these English teacher training programs in Dublin for the past 7 years. But the instructor here, Ros Barwise, has noticed something recently. The kind of people coming on her courses has changed.
Normally it would be young people who perhaps finished school and are just wanting to do something different for a year, go off and teach English. But now the sort of people who are coming on the course are people who feel they have to leave Ireland. Solicitors, architects, hedge fund managers. There's no work for them and there's no point in waiting around in Ireland.
And it seems that an increasing number of people are not waiting around here any longer. Figures from the EU suggest that Ireland now has the second highest number of people leaving of any country in Europe. And what's so odd is that last time I was here, I was reporting on the huge number of people immigrating to Ireland, each of them hoping to get a share of the bountiful money being made in the land of the Celtic Tiger. Well, that's all over now, it seems. The economy has crashed, unemployment is soaring, and a new generation of Irish emigrants is heading for the door.
In Australia, for instance, the number of Irish people on working holiday visas has rocketed, and the number of people going there as permanent immigrants is also increasing. But Irish people we know as well are going to Canada and to Britain as well in greatly increased numbers.
Pierce McHenry is a lecturer in migration studies at University College in Cork.
You had the collapse of the property sector. The young men who were employed in that industry found themselves unemployed overnight, and many of them have left. At the same time, we've had a collapse in the public sector employment as well. Because of the economic crisis, the government has a moratorium on employment in the public sector, and that has led as well to highly qualified graduates leaving the country in large numbers.
And this is where the story ends for many people, or perhaps where new stories begin. I'm at the departure lounge of Dublin Airport, where around me people are saying very sad, tearful farewells to their families.
My name is Joanne Armstrong, and the only option was, if I wanted to make something of myself, was to leave this country. I was never going to make something of myself here. We had to go.
You're going to Australia?
Yeah, obviously family, we'll miss the family and all that, but as I don't think this country has very much to offer anybody at the moment.
Also at the airport was Bridget, waving goodbye to her daughter, who was also heading off for Australia.
I didn't think it was going to happen to this generation, because it seemed to be there was no end to how much money we could earn, and people thought it was going to go on forever. It hasn't done that.
And now you've got to say goodbye to your daughter.
Yes, I do. I do. We're looking at it that it's an adventure, but I'm heartbroken, but very brave. It has to get better.
That report from the BBC's Paul Moss in Dublin. And some other international news we're following. World leaders meet today in London, and they've agreed on a timetable for the handover of security duties in some Afghan provinces later this year. And they've pledged funds they hope will lure Taliban fighters to renounce violence. Today's New York Times reports that the U.S. military will pay the leaders of one of the largest Pashtun tribes in Afghanistan $1 million for development projects in exchange for their help in battling insurgents and supporting the Afghan central government. Coming up, the culture wars head to the Super Bowl. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. The Super Bowl is 11 days away, but a Game Time commercial is already kicking up some controversy. CBS has decided to air an ad that critics say conveys an anti-abortion message. The spot, from the conservative group Focus on the Family, features college football star and Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow, alongside his mother Pam, who talks about how her doctor recommended she have an abortion due to severe complications in her pregnancy. But Pam Tebow declined the advice. The Tebows recently spoke to the media about what the doctor said.
She called our son a mass of fetal tissue, but we didn't believe that he was a mass of fetal tissue because we had prayed for Timothy by name, so we believed that we would just trust him to God.
I'm really thankful that my mom didn't choose to have an abortion, and, you know, I'm still here.
A national coalition of women's groups is calling on CBS to pull the commercial. Jemu Green of the Women's Media Center debated the issue with Bill O'Reilly on Fox News this week.
I think it's that very choice that Pam Tebow was allowed to make about her reproductive health decisions that this ad is trying to take away from all American women.
If it's a positive...
Here and now, media analyst John Carroll joins us. And John, reportedly the word abortion does not appear in this spot, but the group that paid for it, Focus on the Family, is against abortion. So where does the ad stand in terms of past criteria for Super Bowl commercials?
Well, all the networks have sort of a moving target for criteria for advocacy ads, but traditionally Super Bowl broadcasters have been allergic to controversy. So this is an unusual step for CBS, and complicating matters is that CBS has turned down previously advocacy ads on the Super Bowl from groups like MoveOn.org, which wanted to do an ad in 2004 about the federal deficit, and also an ad from the United Church of Christ, which wanted to address the issue of gays and diversity in religious organizations.
But nevertheless, a CBS spokesperson has said that the network approved the script for the ad, saying that it was appropriate for air, and that even though they've rejected other ads in the past, it was time for advocacy ads to be okay during Super Bowl broadcasts. So the network itself seems to have shifted its perspective.
The network has had a problem selling ads for this Super Bowl broadcast. Some of the ads, anyway, are selling for less than they sold for last year. The ads have always gone up in cost. So I think it seems to be all about the economy. In fairness to CBS, they say that they've moderated their approach to reflect public sentiment and industry norms. There are no industry norms. The industry norms are, what do you think you can reasonably do at this point? Right now, networks are looking at, what's the situation, what's the upside, what's the downside? And CBS has decided that the upside is they'll have another $2.5 million.
Yeah, and the way the economy has been, I understand that last year FedEx and General Motors bowed out of putting ads in the Super Bowl. This year, Pepsi is likely not to have an ad, which is a major departure for that company. So we're seeing a lot of space and a lot of lost revenue for a major broadcaster.
Yeah, and we're seeing some situational standards from CBS. In fact, they said to the United Church of Christ, hey, if you want to come and run an ad this year, we'll take it. And the United Church of Christ said, you know what, we'll take our $2.5 million and send it to Haiti. Thank you very much.
So finance is really driving this on the side of CBS. But do you think that if the ad had featured someone who wasn't as famous as Tim Tebow, not a Heisman Trophy winner, just an average American mom and her story about her child, that they would have agreed to air this ad?
I think it's unlikely. I think one of the things that this ad has going for it from CBS's standpoint is that it's so compatible with the Super Bowl. And you've got a very low-key approach to this issue. So from their standpoint, it's a safer ad to run than some other ads around this issue might be.
Well, given the fluidity of the economy and the situation, it seems a little hard to imagine that once you open that door, things can move backward, even if Pepsi and Frito-Lay and FedEx all come running back to those 98 million viewers who are watching the Super Bowl every year.
I think a lot's going to hinge on what the reaction to this ad is. I think going forward, if this ad is effective for Focus on the Family, then I think other advocacy groups are going to look at this as an opportunity, and networks may look at it as an opportunity. But if there's a negative outcome from this ad effort, I think that networks will shy away in the future.
John Carroll is a mass communication professor at Boston University and Here and Now's very own media analyst. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Magna.
A mighty roar has gone up amongst lovers of haggis, the Scottish national dish, because the United States is soon expected to lift a ban on this type of sausage that's made with all manner of sheep organs. Haggis from Scotland has been banned in the U.S. for the past 20 years due to the scare over mad cow disease. And ever since, the absence in the United States of the authentic Highland delicacy has put a damper on annual poetry celebrations at this time of year that honor 18th century Scottish poet Robert Burns, who himself wrote an ode to haggis.
Fair for your honest sonsy face, great chieftain o' the puddin' race, aboon them a' ye tak your place, panch, tripe or therm, weel are ye worthy o' grace, as lang's my arm.
That's our colleague and proud Scotsman, James Ross, reading the opening lines of Burns' Address to a Haggis. Margaret Frost heads the Scottish American Society in Ohio, and she joins us on the line. And Margaret, what does lifting the ban on haggis mean for Scottish Americans?
Well, it means they get a taste of the authentic product once again.
And why is it that it makes a difference that you have the authentic product versus one that you could get here in the United States?
Well, here in the United States, there's long been a ban by, I think, probably the Agriculture Department on using certain portions of the sheep, the lungs, for example, that they are allowed to use in Scotland to make the haggis. And without using those, it's really difficult to get an authentic taste. I just plain like the taste of Scottish haggis better.
Give us the short recipe for haggis. What exactly is in it?
You know, the Scots are a very frugal people. They are also, for the most part, in olden times, a rather poor people. So it was all the stuff that you normally would throw away, the lungs and the liver and various organ meats tied up in intestines.
And boiled to perfection and served with a shot of whiskey, I believe. So maybe the fact that it's all that awful, if I can say that, that might explain all those haggis jokes that Scots and those who follow Scottish tradition might know, such as, you know, if you win a prize, a haggis dinner for two, the second prize is having to eat the haggis, and the first prize is not having to eat the haggis at all. So why is it, do you think, haggis has got such a funny history here?
Oh, I think the Scots like to make fun of themselves. They have a very wry sense of humor. I wouldn't doubt for a minute that the jokes originated right there.
Well, Margaret Frost heads the Scottish American Society in Ohio. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Back in a moment, you're listening to Here and Now. We want to take some time now to note the passing of one of America's most popular historians. Former Boston University professor Howard Zinn died of a heart attack in Santa Monica, California yesterday. He was 87. When Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, was first published in 1980, the initial printing was only 5,000 copies. But in 2003, sales reached 1 million copies. And it was even mentioned in the Academy Award-winning film, Good Will Hunting. But it also drew criticism from fellow historians for its left-leaning interpretation of events. Zinn's book celebrated workers, feminists, and war resistors while charging Christopher Columbus with genocide and being openly critical of American leaders throughout history. Here and Now's Robin Young spoke with Howard Zinn in 2008 about the graphic novel version of his book, and we hope you enjoy this excerpt of their conversation.
All the warts are there. The massacre at Wounded Knee, federal troops firing on striking railroad workers in Chicago, overt wars in Cuba, the Philippines, covert wars, Iran-Contra. Whether you think it's clear-eyed or anti-American, one thing it is unrelenting. Unrelenting. What?
I know the feeling. Well, the truth is, we've had war after war after war. We've had incursion after incursion after incursion, first into Indian territory, then into the Caribbean, then into the Pacific, and it's still going on. So if you tell an honest story, yes, it's going to be relentless. But there's something else that has to be taken into consideration before you become suicidal in the thought, oh, my God, everything is just bad. Mm-hmm. The other side of it is that there have always been Americans who have protested this. We've had anti-war protesters all through history. That means to me that when you tell the true story of American expansion and war-making, it is not anti-American unless you think only the government is American.
You've said that your vision of history is a sort of a counterweight to the one that leaves out a lot of these details, but also to cite those people who you think are heroes, and that, as you've said, is a positive thing, is a good thing. But I'm just thinking of a colleague's son was reading the book and he started wailing, I hate America. I mean, what are we supposed to do with all this information?
No, you can't hate America. You have to be angry at the leaders of the government who have led us into war. You have to be angry at the war profiteers. But it is important to point out to these young people that there have always been people who resisted this, and that these are the people to emulate.
And you do point to moments of your own intense pride. You were a World War II bombardier making food drops over Holland, and you saw what from the hatch? You saw what below in the tulip
fields? That was one of those lost moments in history, which I have never heard described anywhere.
Me neither.
And when I describe it myself, I almost can't believe it. But we were coming back. The last days of the war, and we were dropping this food to people in Holland. And on one of these missions, as we left Amsterdam, we saw out in the field these huge letters made up of tulips, which read, thank you.
Oh.
When I think of it now, you know, I'm still overwhelmed.
I can see how deeply that affected you to have that memory from what you saw through that hatch. Yeah. So it's like you want to be one of those Americans that people spell out thank you in tulips to. But you also write that during World War II, you were asked to bomb a town in France. You say afterwards you realized unnecessarily. I mean, now your officers told you that there were Germans hiding out there. But you say what?
The war was almost over. Everybody knew it. We were a few weeks from the end of the war. And still, they sent us over this tiny French town on the Atlantic coast, Royan, because there were a few thousand German soldiers that weren't doing anything. They're waiting for the war to end. And we sent 1,200 heavy bombers over to drop napalm.
And you didn't know it at the time. You the illustrations in the cartoon are you in a, you know, in your bomber jacket and others walking around loading the planes. What's that we're loading? Some sticky stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But I suppose my own experience illustrates the fact that once you're in the military, you just go ahead automatically and do what you're told. I think one of the lessons that I want to impart is don't do what you're told. Think for yourself. Ask whether this is right or wrong. And so we killed several thousand people on this raid.
French and Germans.
French and Germans, yes. Oh, sure, you know, it's the good war because we defeated Hitler. I had volunteered for it because that's how I saw it, as a war against fascism.
And evil.
Yeah, but we did evil things.
How did you come to be this person who, when you see something that appears to be unfair or someone who is disenfranchised? Let's tell a little bit of your story, because it's in the book. We see you growing up poor in Brooklyn.
My parents, you know, were immigrants and semi-literate, and there was not a book in the house, you see, but I found a book, and then that led me to read other books, Upton Sinclair, Jack London.
And the newspaper.
Yeah.
And your dad is a hardworking waiter, and you go help him on there's certain days where fathers can bring their children to help them holidays.
Yes.
And you see what?
I see how hard my father works. Yeah. I see how hard people work to just barely survive. Later on, when I was teaching at Boston University, some of my students who came from very successful families would say, you know, in America, if you work hard, you know, you will make it, suggesting that if you hadn't made it, if you hadn't become wealthy, you didn't work hard. Yeah. Well, I knew this was not true.
Seeing that affected you, seeing your father sweat as a waiter, but there's a moment when you become radicalized, and a crack on the head will do that. It was your first demonstration. You were protesting the Nazis.
You know, the truth is, at that moment, I was 17 years old. I wasn't sure what I was I thought it was something good. You know, anti-war, anti-fascist, and I got knocked on the head by a policeman. It was an awakening because I realized that the police will very often be on the side of the oppressor.
Well, the irony is that you get cracked on the head at that protest against fascism, the Nazis, and then you would become someone asked to bomb them.
Well, there's a lot of things that don't make sense. That's what we're trying to point out when we write books.
But when you see the Gulf of Tonkin incident that tripwires the war in Vietnam, at least at that level, and then later it's found that there was no Gulf of Tonkin incident, when you see weapons of mass destruction used to go to war in Iraq, there were no weapons of mass destruction. When you see reports of a massacre that triggered a war with the Philippines in the late 1800s, and there turns out not to have been true, what are you thinking as an historian?
Well, you know, I'm thinking that it is very important for young people to see the persistence of deception, to understand it's not just this war. It's a long historic fact, this fact of deception of the people getting them into war. I mean, the whole point of a book on history like this, which tries to tell, I think, honestly, the history of the United States, is to say the problems we see today are not just today. They're deep-rooted, and therefore we have a big job to do to uproot these fundamental wrongs that have been going on.
Well, at the end of the book, you hope readers will not be too discouraged by the way the world looks.
We shouldn't be discouraged because we should think back, and that's where history comes in handy, to all those times when people were discouraged, but they persisted and they won. I mean, the anti-slavery movement, it was tiny. How in the world were they going to do away with slavery? But they persisted and persisted, and a great movement grew. And I think we have to get used to the idea that there's no one simple ending solution when suddenly everything is okay. We have to get used to the fact that life is a struggle to make things better and better. You win, you lose, you win, you lose. You mustn't give up. If you give up, you'll always lose. And if you persist, you have a chance.